in case you're worried about Bilbo Baggins, he's okay. He did not get fried in that blast from the dragon. But I was thinking about the whole idea of hoarding or of gathering and overgathering, and I thought of that scene because, you know, you can't get much greedier than a dragon. So that just seemed appropriate. So, you know, I read an article several years ago in Time Magazine, and it asked this question: is your pilot ready for surprises? Journalist Sally Donnelly described an experience that she had when she was in a Learjet over New Mexico, and this is what she wrote. She said, "We were cruising along smoothly when suddenly the plane jerked sideways like a car getting rammed broadside. We began fishtailing and then rocking and then doing both at the same time. One wing dipped, and within 3 seconds, the plane was rolling sideways and then over, and we were looking up at the ground. Then," she said, "almost as fast as it happened, the pilot regained control, and he guided the plane back to right side up." Now, the article went on to explain that as frightening as that experience was, it was all part of a simulated mid-air experience, an emergency that they enacted, you know, in a real plane, but it was to help train pilots to be prepared in case there was a loss of control. It was to prevent actually losing control that would be catastrophic. Now, granted, nobody can be ready for every emergency, and certainly there are airline accidents that were no fault of the pilots. It's just the way things go. But there is something to be said for being prepared. In fact, experts suggest that we prepare for airline emergencies, and now it's active shooter emergencies, right? And there's preparation about that. There are food emergencies. There are health emergencies. You know, with food, if you've popped popcorn and you don't know for a fact that you have butter, I mean, that's a travesty waiting to happen. I mean, you need to prepare in advance for what you're getting ready for. Well, just as experts would suggest those kinds of preparations, we're also told that we need to have financial preparedness because of the possibility of emergencies as well. In fact, the Bible agrees with that. And so as we continue this series that we're in, it's called Passing Go, What to Do with What You Get, we're going to talk today about the discipline of saving. I know it doesn't sound terribly exciting, but hopefully we'll learn some things together. In the game Monopoly, every time you pass Go, you collect $200, so that's payday. Now, your payday may be less than that. It may be way more than that. But whether you're like I was when I was a kid and I got a dollar a week allowance, or whether you're a six-figure income, there are financial principles that apply for all of us and that can be important for all of us to understand. Debt is at an all-time high, and so many people feel like, we're talking about saving, I can't even pay my bills, I can totally tune out on this one because saving is not on my radar at all. But Scripture is clear that if we're going to use our money wisely, this is a part of how we do that. The challenge is that there's kind of a balancing act we have to do. We want to save wisely, but we don't want to hoard like certain dragons that will remain unnamed that we could talk about, right? We want to save but not hoard. Jesus said in Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other, but you cannot serve both God and money. And so how can we make sure that we discipline ourselves to save, and yet we overcome the temptation to make money too important or to hoard it selfishly? Well, the Bible offers us some insight that we're going to get into in just a few minutes. But before we specifically talk about saving, I just want you to understand, kind of in summary, a little bit of things we've already talked about, that we have a choice we can make when it comes to how we use our money, and really how we use our lives in general. One thing we can do is we can waste it. Right, this is kind of the live for today, if it feels good, do it mindset. It's like the prodigal son we talked about a couple of weeks ago. He wanted to indulge today, and who cares about tomorrow? Not even going to give that a second thought. It's kind of the Frank Sinatra, I did it my way. It's Madonna's Material Girl. It's Lady Gaga's Money Honey. Right, every generation has songs that talk about indulging. It's the college student who lives to party on Saturday night. It's the business executive who thinks that just making more and more money is the essence of life. It's that guy at work who will talk about nothing except the last conquest that he had, right? Life can be wasted. Money can be wasted. Now, another option is that we can spend it, right? These are the people who kind of spend their lives on career, on family. Maybe they stand up for a cause like saving the whales or preventing forest fires. Nothing wrong with that at all. They might spend their money on a home mortgage, and they buy groceries, they pay their taxes, they do an occasional vacation, maybe play a game of golf once in a while, maybe get a big screen TV for Christmas, you know? These are honest, hardworking people. They put their time in. They do their best. But when it's over, they just kind of leave it for somebody else, and they go on, and there's not really a lot to show for it. It's not that they're doing things wrong. It's just that they really haven't made the most of their lives or their resources. So that kind of brings us to that third option of investing, right? We can invest our time. We can invest our energy, our talent, our money, and we can do all of that strategically. And in a spiritual way, this kind of encompasses the whole idea of being a faithful steward of what God has given to us. We devote ourselves to things that will outlast us, to things that are bigger than we are. We sow now, we reap later. We determine that we invest our lives and our finances in a way that is going to guarantee some meaningful dividends later on. I listened to a book on tape one time by Charles Kuralt, and he offered this quote. He said, "A man stands tall who plants a tree in whose shade he never intends to sit." It's about thinking beyond yourself. My son Aaron, for Christmas, gave me the soundtrack to the new Broadway musical, Hamilton. Man, I mean, it's an amazing musical. And one of the songs says that legacy is planting seeds in a garden that you never get to see. And both of those quotes kind of say the same thing, that when it comes to our lives, we need to do something with them that is beyond us, that's going to matter later on for others down the road. When it comes to life, when it comes to money, we can waste it, we can spend it, we can invest it. There's an old story kind of made the rounds with preachers years ago about a guy stranded in the desert, and he comes across a pump, and it says by a sign that deep underground there's a well and that there's plenty of water if he'll just follow the directions. So there's a note there that says, and there's a note, and there's a bottle of water tightly corked, and the note says, "Don't drink the water. Pour the water into the pump. You prime the pump. You'll be able to pump up as much water as you need. When you're finished, refill the bottle for the next guy." And it takes a certain amount of faith, because you need water and there's water. Now, you could drink that water and satisfy your thirst and the water be gone. You could say, "I don't like hot water," and you could pour it out on the ground and you could waste it and nobody benefit, or you could prime the pump, have plenty of water for yourself, and then be ready for the next person who comes along. And so it's that whole idea of you waste it, you spend it, or you invest it. The truth is, most of us will handle a sizable amount of money in our lifetime. If you earn $20,000 a year for 40 years, you will have made $800,000 in the course of your career. If you earn $50,000 a year for 40 years, you will have managed $2 million. $100,000 a year, $4 million. Now, what do you do with all that money? Do you waste it? Do you spend it? Do you invest it? See, it's a choice that we make. And I'm not talking about investing specifically in the stock market or something. It's just how we use it well, use it wisely. The Bible suggests that wise money managers save part of what they have. And before we talk specifically about that, I want to show you a danger we have to avoid. So the question is, can we save too much? And I believe we can. The Bible talks about the whole idea of hoarding. When I was a kid, I read a story, a true story, about a woman named Hetty Green. Ms. Green's existence was so meager, it was said that she lived on cold oatmeal because she had nothing in her apartment with which to heat the oatmeal that she ate. Her son had to have his leg amputated because she couldn't find a free medical clinic that would treat him. When she died in 1916, they found in her apartment an old tin cup with four little scraps of soap in it. Just kind of one more example of a very meager life. And you might look at Hetty Green and say, "Well, this woman was a tragic example of poverty." Well, Henrietta Howland Green, when she died in 1916, she had an estate worth $95 million. In 1916, she had more than $31 million in one bank account. She made her daughter's fiancé sign a prenuptial agreement that he would get none of the money. She herself, she refused to have a hernia operation because it was going to cost her $150. All these resources wasted. Now, I don't know if she was mentally ill. I don't know if she was paranoid. I don't know if she was just selfish. But she held on so tightly to every dime that she failed to live her life. Now, that's an extreme example, but really, the mindset is not so uncommon. There are people who work hard to save for a rainy day, and they do so much of that that they never enjoy the sunshine. And that's so profound. If I say so myself, I'm going to say it again, okay? Some people work so hard to save for a rainy day that they never enjoy the sunshine. I'll show you an example in the Bible. Jesus told a parable, one of these fictional stories to prove an important truth. And this is what he said in Luke 12, beginning in verse 13. He said, someone in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. I mean, Jesus is preaching a sermon. This guy says, hang on just a second. My brother's not fair. He's a big meanie. Will you tell him to do the right thing? And Jesus says, man, who appointed me judge or arbiter between you? And then he said, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Now, whether this guy's complaint about his brother was legitimate or not, Jesus went on to tell a parable about the importance of how we deal with money. I mean, talk about being quick on your feet. Jesus is talking about one thing. This guy asked a question, and so Jesus totally changes gears. Don't do that to me, okay? I got things to say I want to get said. Verse 16, the ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. And then he said, this is what I will do. I'll tear down my barns. I'll build bigger ones. And there I will store all of my grain and all of my goods. And I'll say to myself, self, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? God entrusted this man with wealth, a great deal of wealth. He had a really good year. And that happens sometimes, whether you're farming, whether you're in business, maybe your investments. Sometimes you just have a good year. The Bible says that the sun shines, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. Sometimes mean people are really blessed. This was just a good year. This guy had a good year. But the way he responded to that good year led to his downfall. When his life was over, God said that he was a fool. And I want to show you the mistakes that he made that ultimately led to that downfall. First of all, he neglected to thank God for the blessings. Rather than seeing his abundance as something from the Lord, he looked at it all as his. Look again at verse 17. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crop. It's mine. Now, he had worked hard for it. You know, his hands were calloused. His muscles were strong, probably had a redneck. You know, I mean, he'd been out in the sun. He'd been working hard. But he took credit for all of it. This is his. You know, in the Old Testament book of Habakkuk, in chapter 1, there's this guy that's kind of speaking tongue-in-cheek that was so thrilled with his fishing that he offered sacrifices to his nets as if they were the ones responsible for the blessing in his life. That was this guy, right? Everything was about him and his life of luxury. He was deceived. It never occurred to him that God had provided good things to him, that God gave him strength for his task, that God sent the sunshine and the rain, that God put the nutrients in the soil in the first place. He wasn't aware of John 15, 5, where Jesus says, apart from me, you can do nothing. Right? He didn't give credit where credit was due. James 1, 16 says, don't be deceived. Every good gift is from above, coming down from our Father in heaven. God is the source of all that we have, and so we need to be grateful. Now, the second thing this rich fool thought was that he thought only of himself. Look again at verse 18. He said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns. I'll build bigger ones. There I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Take life easy. Did you notice the conversation this guy had with himself? My crops, my barns, my grain, my goods. 11 times in his little speech here, he uses the word I or my. The only time he says you, he was talking to himself. There are so many things this guy could have done with his money, so many positive things out of his abundance. He could have sold some of that excess grain. He could have given the money to build a school or to build a hospital or a church or an orphanage. He could have shared his crops with people who didn't have such a good year. He could have paid to send some missionaries to far-off lands. But man, all he wanted to do was hoard his wealth for himself. Got to have bigger barns because I got so much. Listen, it's not wrong to invest money to earn more. It's not wrong to save money to take care of yourself later in life, to leave an inheritance for your kids. But it is wrong to hold on to everything when there are desperate needs all around you. to stockpile every resource and refuse to be generous with God. This farmer in our text kind of had the philosophy that we see so prevalently in our culture. I'm going to take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. See, he kind of epitomized both dangers of materialism, right? He hoarded his wealth, but it was so he could indulge himself. But the worst thing of all is that this rich fool made no provision for eternity. Verse 20, God said to him, you're a fool. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? The problem is that this guy never considered God's hand in the events of his life. He thought he was in control. He had a plan, but he never realized that God had a plan too, and that God's plan wins out. He failed to look far enough ahead. Oh, sure, he thought about next year. I can coast next year because of this year. Maybe he thought about retirement and how good life was going to be. Maybe he even did his family a favor, prepaid his funeral so they wouldn't have to worry about it after he was gone. But he never thought about what happened after that. He gave no thought at all to his future beyond the grave. And God called him a fool and demanded his life from him. And Jesus concluded in verse 21, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. You know, I think one of the most profound verses in the Bible is Matthew 16, 26. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but he loses his soul? James wrote in his epistle that when we make plans apart from God, we're being arrogant, presumptuous, and evil. The rich fool in our text learned that hoarding is futile because not so much that wealth is uncertain, but because life is uncertain. And so that kind of brings us around then to some application. We don't want to waste our money. We don't want to even just spend our money. We'd like to invest our money wisely. Part of that is saving something to live on. Part of it is not hoarding, but just being prudent. And how do we balance all of that? You know, I was reading in a Reader's Digest, this has been some years ago, back when ATM machines were first getting popular and people were getting kind of used to that whole thing. There was a woman who lived in a college town and she was trying to use her card at the ATM machine for the first time. And she was having a little trouble and she noticed there was a guy waiting for the machine behind her and he looked like a college student. She figured he was tech savvy. So she asked if he would help him. He said, sure he would. And he came up to the window there with her and she has her card there trying to figure it out and she's trying to make a deposit. And he laughed and said, oh, I can't help you with that. I've never done that before. Never put anything into one of those machines. Just take it out. Solomon wrote in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6, go to the ant or look at the ant, you sluggard. I love that word sluggard. That's just such a one of those words you can really get your arms around. Consider the ant's ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. Ants are smarter than us sometimes. The ant is commended for storing away something for future use. Now, what does this suggest? Well, a first suggestion is just that we need to train ourselves to save something. Something. Remember the verse we read a couple of weeks ago in Proverbs 21, 20? A foolish man devours all that he has. We have to break the cycle of spending every dime that we make. I saw a billboard up in Indiana one day, and it was at one of those cash advance lending places, and it said on the billboard, we'll cash tomorrow's check today. I think it was loansharks.com or something like that. I don't know. I mean, come on. We've spent so much that we have to cash tomorrow's check today to pay for yesterday. We need to discipline ourselves to save something. Even if you're digging yourself out of debt, friends, I would just challenge you. The discipline of saving something is an important step to get started. Now, there are a couple of different kinds of saving, right? There's long-term savings and short-term savings. Short-term savings are for things like emergencies. Man, you got to have a set of tires. Believe me, I know about those. All right, you have an appliance that's gone down. You need a vehicle worked on. Maybe you've lost your job. And so Larry Burkett, you know, who does a lot of financial planning and advice, especially among Christian audiences, he talks about a baby step emergency fund that you ought to set a goal. I'm going to save $1,000 and I'm going to have that set aside for an emergency, and you make that a first step goal. Then he goes on to talk about, this is kind of sobering, experts suggest 3 to 6 months salary put away somewhere where you can get to it if you need to, which is pretty overwhelming if you're like me, but that's a suggestion. And that's just kind of a benchmark to say that's not really a hoarding thing. That's just a trying to be wise because you never know what life might do to you. But then long-term savings goes on to talk about retirement, IRAs and pensions and mutual funds and all that kind of stuff. Remember those commercials a few years ago asking how are you saving for retirement? And this older couple invites another couple over and they put them on the couch and they bounce them up and down a little bit. And when the couple leaves, they dig around for change in the cushions of the couch. Well, my favorite one was Grandma and Grandpa were flying in. So there's a family there to pick them up at the airport. And the suitcase bounces down the luggage thing and they open it up and Grandma gets out. She's trying to save some money, so she shipped herself. And then she looks a little dazed and says, "Where's Grandpa?" And here comes another big, you know, suitcase bouncing down behind her. You know, I mean, what are you doing for retirement, right? Well, we don't have time to plan your retirement, right? I'm not smart enough. I'm not the guy to tell you how to do that. But I would encourage you to talk to a professional who can help you make some plans. What I will tell you, and you'll hear this more than once as we get to know each other, is there's the 10-10-80 plan. Okay, are you familiar with this? The 10-10-80 plan of finances is that you give 10% to God, you put 10% in short-term and long-term savings in some way, and you live on 80%. You tithe to God, you tithe to yourself, and then you live on the rest. And if we can discipline ourselves to do that, it's powerful what God can do with that. It's not about hoarding, it's about being wise. Which kind of brings us to a second thing. This doesn't sound very spiritual, and maybe I'm in over my head even talking about it because I'm not a numbers guy and a money guy, but make compound interest work for you. This is what the experts say, okay? When you're talking about interest on a debt that you owe, compound interest stinks. I mean, it's painful. But it's why a 30-year mortgage will cost you way more than a 15-year mortgage because of compound interest. But when it's working in your favor, it is the bomb, okay? It is awesome what it will do for you. Proverbs 13:11 says, "Dishonest money dwindles away." But listen, he who gathers money little by little makes it grow. He who gathers money little by little makes it grow. Let's suppose somebody comes to you and says, "I want to give you some money." You say, "Great." They say, "I'm going to give you a penny today, and then tomorrow I'm going to double it. I'll double that again the next day, and the next day, and I'll double it all for 30 days. And you're thinking, "Well, I mean, it's not a lot of money, but I mean, it's free. Sure, I'll take the money." Then they say, "Well, wait a second. If you'd rather have your money right now, I'll give you $1 million right now." Which do you choose? If you will wait 30 days, you will have, let me find it in my notes here, $5,368,708.80. You say, "Really? Come on." One penny becomes two pennies, two becomes four, four becomes eight, eight becomes 16. At the end of a week, you have 64 cents. Woo! Don't cash in at the end of the week. Because if you'll wait 30 days, you keep doubling every day over $5.3 million. That's compound interest. Now, if you find a deal that will double your money every day, don't take it because it's going to probably put you in jail. I'm just saying, okay? But the concept is there. Let me kind of put it in more practical numbers. Let's say that you discipline yourself to save $100 a month. And you could earn 7% interest. Sometimes that's really good, sometimes not so good. But let's say you earn 7% interest. At the end of 10 years, you'd have $17,000. If you did $100 a month for 20 years, at the end of that time, you'd have $50,000 at 7% interest. If you saved $100 a month for 40 years, you'd have more than $240,000. And I'm talking to some of you younger folks. Get started, I'm telling you, okay? Those of us who don't have 40 years, it's a different story. But it's the power of compound interest. $200 a month for 40 years would be nearly $500,000. Yeah, it takes patience. But there's a cumulative effect to doing little things over time. He who gathers money little by little makes it grow, Proverbs says. And that's why we have to refuse to panic, okay? But we need to kind of think long term. Ken Davis is a Christian comedian, a hilarious guy. He said he came home one day and his little girl was there and she had a string tied around her tooth. The other was tied to a doorknob and she slammed the door and it jerked her head. And she opened the door and slammed it again, jerked her head again. He said, "Let me see that tooth." He wiggled it, said, "That tooth's not even loose." She said, "Leave me alone. I need the money." You know, some of us get so desperate about money. "I got to have it. I got to have it right now. I'm going to pull it out and do it, you know, whatever." And it's like we just need to kind of show some patience and believe that time is on our side here, that time can be our friend. I was reading one time in Time magazine at a time when things were pretty rocky with the market. And this guy wrote in a letter to the editor and said, "The good news is that a stock's price cannot fall below zero. So fortunately, the most you can lose is everything." That's kind of depressing. Okay, it's tempting to give in to despair. In a more serious way, I read about a new phenomenon that's kind of arisen in the past few years. Two economists from Princeton University have begun studying this. They refer to this as deaths of despair. Apparently, mortality rates in America have been declining among all social classes and races for the past 100 years. In other words, people have been living longer and longer over the past 100 years, all social classes, all races. Except in recent years, people have, or the mortality rates have been going up, lives have been shorter in one cross-section of people. Middle-aged white men with a high school degree or less. Their death rates have increased a half a percentage point every year for the last 15 years. They began to study, why are those mortality rates going up, lifespan going down for 45 to 54-year-olds and not in any other cross-section in our country? Do you know why? Suicide and alcohol and drug-related deaths. And so they're calling these deaths by despair. They're the number one and number three leading cause of death in this cross-section of people because people are freaking out because the job market's getting tougher, technology is outpacing middle-aged folks, and the market is so erratic. And so people, it's leading to hopelessness and despair. Now listen, you may not be ready to throw yourself off the bell tower at the courthouse, and I hope you're not drowning in Jim Beam, but the reality is, we can all give way to anxiety at times when it comes to money. We need to realize that God is still on the throne, that we're going to be okay. Just give things time. A lot of times things turn around. This is not the most spiritual thing in the world, but I read this in a magazine one time. Dr. Walter Williams, an economist from George Mason University, said, in the history of our country, there's never been a 20-year span of time when the market did not go up 10% or more. And so don't freak out. Things will bounce back. That's at least been the typical thing. Proverbs 28:25 says, a greedy man stirs up dissension, but he who trusts in the Lord will prosper. He who trusts in the Lord will be taken care of. The Apostle Paul tells us, this is a big one, Philippians 4:19, my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. Rick Warren asked his church one time, he said, look, if you could leave here today knowing that you had $200,000 in the bank, or you could leave here today knowing that God was going to meet all your needs according to Jesus, which would make you feel more secure? I mean, seriously, which is a better promise? God will meet your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. Don't despair. And then the last thing I would suggest to you is that we have to invest in eternity first. We talked about this some last week. Matthew 6:19 says, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth. In other words, don't just hoard everything you got. It's not all about you. Moth and rust destroy. Thieves could break in and steal. Store up treasure in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. We store up for ourselves treasures in heaven. Again, Rick Warren said, you know how you do that? You know how you store up treasure in heaven? You invest in people who are going there. You store up treasure in heaven by investing in people who are going there. Yes, sure, it's a good idea to save for yourself, for emergencies, to save for your retirement, maybe to leave an inheritance. All that's fine. But as we invest our time and our money and our resources in people who either are already on their way to heaven or desperately need to know how to get there, that's how we're putting our treasure where it really, really belongs. So save a little. Let compound interest work for you. Don't panic. Okay, and then invest in eternity first. My God will meet all your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. Now, as we wrap up, I want to ask you a trivia question, okay? What four words have been on every American coin that's ever been minted? That is a great answer. It's wrong, but it's a great answer. That's what I thought it was going to be. I wanted you to say that. And so, according to Trivial Pursuit game, if this is true, it's the United States. It's just United States of America. Those are the four words that have been on every coin. But it made me think, when did In God We Trust show up on coins? And so I did a little research. I went to the source of all wisdom and all knowledge, Wikipedia, and I found out that in 1864, In God We Trust was put on our 1 cent and 2 cent coins. And according to some people, it suggested that it was put on, that was Civil War era, it was put on there to show the South that the North was more spiritual. I'll stay out of that debate. But anyway, that's where it first appeared, and then in the early 1900s, it became popular. They were putting it on different coins at different times. By 1938, it was mandated that all coins would have In God We Trust stamped on them. I found this interesting. It was not until 1956 that that actually became the official national motto, "In God We Trust." 1957, it had to be put on paper currency as well. And so all of the money that you handle now should say, "In God We Trust," unless you're handling other money from other countries. Now, I like that our country has the phrase, "In God We Trust." And I don't like it just because I'm a preacher and we're supposed to like stuff like that. I like it because we are tempted to believe in money we trust. Now, we wouldn't say that out loud. Hopefully, we would never print it on our money. But a lot of us live that way. They think, you know, if I just have enough money in the bank, or I just have enough money shoved under my mattress, or I just have enough money in my IRA, or if I just have enough money that I'm anticipating in an inheritance, everything will be fine. Nothing can touch me. Nothing can get to me as long as I have enough money. In money we trust. But friends, you know as well as I do that we can't trust money. For multiple reasons, you cannot put your hope there. Now, you can save money, and I hope that you will, and I suggest that you do. But you don't save money so that money can save you. So that's what a lot of people think. If I just save money, money will save me. It doesn't work that way. Money cannot save you, right? When you're lying on your deathbed, when you're lying in the casket, when you're standing at the gates of heaven, your money will do nothing for you. It is a relationship with Jesus Christ that saves. You know, one of my pet peeves is trust funds, the phrase. Now, I know it's just a financial expression, no big deal, but we don't trust in funds, right? We trust in the Lord. That's what saves. Jesus Christ is what saves. Our decision about Jesus is what saves. If you like to keep track of bottom lines, the bottom line is just simply, in God we trust. It's not in money we trust. It's not in me we trust. In God we trust.